We're going to go on to our panel.
Engaging families as a unit, including parents, is the largest challenge facing literacy and many other supporters for children in the 0-5 space. In this panel, we are digging into the second generational approach of Reach Out and Read and the unique access provided through the medical home. So with that, we'll introduce our panel.
Thank you very much. Great to be here today. My name is Dipesh Navsarya. I'm a pediatrician at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I'm also on the National Board of Directors of Reach Out and Read National Center, and I'm Medical Director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin. It's great to be back here. I was here 2 years ago as a speaker, and really a delight to be here again. The photos, as you can see on the slides, are of each of us working, reading with children. The one of me there in the lower left there is showing a book to a little baby, actually at one of our free clinics. And this is a clinic that operates in a homeless shelter. And I was showing this book as part of Reach Out and Read to a mother, and I actually remember that interaction very well. Because you know this baby, as you can see in the photo, is looking at those baby faces, just leaning forward, just engaging. And I said, oh, look at how much your baby's loving that book. And this mother, remember, she's in a homeless shelter, looks down at her baby, looks up at me, and says in astonishment, my baby's smart. You know, and it gave her that moment of hope that was just really beautiful and made all the effort we had done to try to set this up in a homeless shelter really worth it. I, besides my pediatric training, I also have a master's in public health. You heard a lot about the public health approach this morning. And I also have a master's in library science in children's librarianship, which is the connection with Reach Out and Read and all. Long story for the whole thing. So, and so on. I'm going to let each of our panelists introduce themselves and maybe say a little something about the photograph, if they'd like, and then we'll... do a little framing about what we'll be discussing over the next hour. So I guess we'll just go in order, perhaps.
Hi, I'm Dr. Candace Prince. I am a newly residencied family practitioner in Newberry, South Carolina, which is about 45 minutes outside of Columbia, if you're not familiar, very rural area. My husband and I both are practicing in that area. We joined about 2 years ago, and our first experience with Reach Out and Read was actually in medical school in Virginia. We had a program there established that we could volunteer and go read in the waiting rooms. I'm sure some of your areas have that set up as well. And then didn't have much through residency in Spartanburg. The program wasn't really established in our residency program. But when we set foot in Newberry, the program was already there. And so we kind of have been trying to regrow that program since it's been a little bit neglected over the past couple of years. And so that's kind of my experience with Reach Out and Read. And we're just trying to develop that more. We see a good fair number of pediatric patients. So.
Thank you. I'm Dr. David Hill. I'm Associate Medical Director of Kids Care Pediatrics in Wilmington, one of my colleagues from across the state we heard from earlier. I'm also the Chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Communications and Media. And most of you probably know us best from the Screen Time Guidelines, which we just revised, right? And made more complicated over the last year, but we'll hopefully have a moment to get into that. In that picture, my practice has a large Hispanic population, and I claim to be bilingual. Nothing will stretch your Spanish vocabulary like live translating a children's book while you're trying to read it. I realize I have a lot of medical vocabulary, but when I'm trying to describe the things that a caterpillar is eating, it gets harder.
Hi, I'm Janice Grundell. We just bought a house in Charlotte. We live in Connecticut, so I have 1 foot, and I'll be your Connecticut Yankee and your converted Carolinian. I have two grandkids here, so there was a little bit of a reason, in addition to the fact that I love the Carolinas. I talk about you guys all the time. I did have the privilege of working in Spartanburg in the north side when we worked on an early learning center and bringing the work that I'm doing now as a consultant to communities, translating the neuroscience in the way that we heard it today that anchors decision processes around policy and practice and programs in what actually works without giving away innovation. One quick word, I worked in Connecticut in child welfare for 13 or 14 years, which is a long time in that particular field. I also helped build a health system in our prisons. Now, I'm a developmental psychologist, so that sounds really weird, right? But we need to be in all of those spaces, and I'm really happy to be with you.
I'm Kristen Cooper, and it says I'm First Lady of North Carolina, which I feel that description always seems, sounds like it should come with a sash and a tiara. But I am a lawyer, and when we started looking at doing some First Ladies initiatives, I sort of drew on my experience working 14 years as a volunteer with the Guardian Ad Litem program representing foster children in the courts in Wake County. And one of the common threads that I see with a lot of the children is the issue of childhood poverty and what sort of contributes to that, and literacy and hunger and being prepared for school. And Reach Out and Read sort of, they reached out to us, and that picture is of me in Asheville, I believe, and reading to being sore on a bunch of kids. And I'm not pointing any fingers, but shortly after that I got the flu. But that's okay. You know, that is one of the occupational hazards of working around little kids, as I'm sure that you all know. But I'm just very honored to be here.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's wonderful to hear everyone's backgrounds and experiences around reading. So on this panel, we'd like to discuss the notion of family, and I'd just like to frame this more broadly in a couple of ways. We heard something earlier today in the keynote that was really important and is something that I've conveyed to audiences when I speak myself many times, but Dr. Susskind actually said it in a more pithy and elegant way than I think I could ever hope to manage, which is that no socioeconomic group, no group of parents, you know, corners the market on loving their children and wanting the best for them. And I have to remind people of this over and over and over, because it is easy in this work of trying to help families to get into this mindset of we need to help someone in particular. Well, first of all, as any of you who are parents know, we all need help, including those of us who do this for a living. My two teenagers remind me of this on a regular basis. But number two is that all parents want the best for their children. I have never run into a parent who doesn't. So what she was talking about was, it's not just the information gap of you should talk to your child, you should read, you should sing, all that stuff. We've actually done a pretty good job with that, right? Billboards and things like that. But it's the skills gap. How do I do that? Which is what she was getting at. And that's where things like Reach Out and Read come in, because you need proper coaching, advice, modeling, mentoring, things like that. And the secret is, even though we think of Reach Out and Read as, you know, this book program and, you know, look at all the pictures of the kids and all that, the secret is it's really a parenting program, right? The change we're trying to elicit is in the parents and the reading behaviors at home. So it's really a two-generation approach. I've had the privilege of working with the Aspen Institute's Ascend program, which looks at two-generation solutions. And really this gets at, how do we change the child and their learning potential, as well as how do we change the parent and their ability to do what they want to do, which is to be a good parent. So that's really what we'll be talking about here, is how do we engage families and how do we really relate and reach out to them. So I'd like to start with a question for Dr. Prince. So thinking about the strengths-based approach, which is, as you know, we don't do a very good job in medicine sometimes. We're always looking for what's wrong, you know, and what's negative and so on. But a strengths-based approach, how does looking at strengths help you discuss literacy with families and really try to engage and create some of this change?
looking at the can you repeat the strength, mm-hmm. like the strengths of the family members mm-hmm. or the strengths of
the strengths of the families, providers? The strengths of the families.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think when we initially talked about this question too, in terms of family, the one thing I thought about was what the definition of family was, and I think that leads into what the strength is. So you really. And I think from me as a family doc, I tend to see the entire family. So there's not a day that goes by that we don't have a what we would term a threefer or a fourfer, which in PEDS, that means three kids all in one room. For us, that could mean two adults, one kid, whatever the combination may be during that actual visit, and we merge visits. And so a lot of times I will actually be seeing the mom or the grandmother and the child. And so I think the answer to that question from my perspective is first identifying what family is for that person and for that particular patient, because one child, it may be their family is what we traditionally think of as a family, which is mom, dad, baby, siblings. But a lot of what we see is grandma, child, or foster children. I see a lot of foster children, and one visit they may be with one person and then they're back with the other parent. And so I think figuring out where that particular child is in their life and what family means for them is kind of the first approach I have with utilizing strengths of that family, because it's different for each one. And I don't know if I exactly answered your question, but that's what I kind of thought about with that question in terms of what family means. And you mentioned a two-generation approach. I think of it as a three-generation and onward, because truly I would say a good percentage of my patients are not even brought in by a parent. It's a grandparent, an aunt, and so extending it even further.
In the world of two-generation work, we often feel like it's the number of blades on a razor. It's going to keep going up till we have a four and a five-generation approach. So, yeah. So, you know, in healthcare, again, we start off with these, we often look for what's wrong. Is there a difference in the quality of conversations when you start off by looking for the strengths and how you discuss things with families?
Yes, I think, and you're right, we do. We look at, we're often approached with what's wrong with healthcare. I think that programs like this are one of our strengths, and bring that to the forefront so that people know that that is available for them. And then strengths two, you know, we have a lot of community programs that are not utilized. And I think that we oftentimes, I, for one, too, entered a community, a rural community. I have no idea the resources. And it's digging in, figuring out what strengths we have to provide to our patients. And I think that's something that's an ongoing process for me, because I still don't know everything that's out there and available for patients. And I think probably there's a lot of heads nodding. A lot of us don't know what all is available. So digging in and figuring out what we can bring to the table to help parents grow and learn with their children as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Dr. Hill, how do you build discussions about language and literacy into your interactions with parents, particularly around building that into routines? And as you noted, besides your impeccable taste in ties, the work you've done in communications and media is significant, and I think there's a lot of interest, as we heard from an earlier question, about the role of digital media. Could you, in not too long, share your thoughts about that?
You bet. So first of all, is that good? There we go. First of all, I have to say that being a reach out and read practice helps a ton in starting that conversation, because you have a gift. I walk into the room. Usually kids are terrified to see me. They associate me with shots. And so, you know, this lets me start not with something scary or something odd, but with something familiar and something I get to walk in the room and give a present. And that opens up this wonderful relationship with the child and with the parent. And from there, you get to start that conversation. You know, I say, I love building libraries. Do you have this book already? Is my first question, partly because they've come to our practice before often. And second of all, they might have gotten it somewhere else. I want to make sure I'm not duplicating. And that gives me an opportunity to talk about, well, how do you read? Who reads? I think we had such a beautifully illustrative story from the speaker over here. in every child's, in the life of every child who succeeds, there is some adult somewhere who guides that child. And sometimes it's a primary caregiver, but sometimes it's somebody that you wouldn't expect, as it was in your case, just a neighbor. And so that gives us an opportunity to start asking the questions. Being on the Council on Communications and Media, one of the things that I try and find out is if there's background television. As part of the 30 million word campaign, I've had the great opportunity to work with one of my heroes. He was a hero before I found out I was going to get to work with him, Dr. Dimitri Christakis. And one of his most famous studies, there's a lot of them, looked at how many words were spoken in a household when the background television was going. And one of the problems with background TV, and I asked the parents, you know, is there a TV on in the background? Yeah, but the child doesn't pay attention to it, right? It's not the child. It's that you're paying attention to it. TV is an incredibly visual medium. It's designed to gather your attention, and it stops the parent from talking dramatically. I think 700 words per hour fewer is what Dr. Christakis found was the decrement in speech. So I talk about that. We talk about the television in terms of sleep. Sleep is critical to healthy brain development. And so we also ask, you know, well, I ask about sleep, and often it's not going great. Was the TV on? A lot of parents don't, they do it to help the child go to sleep when actually it's a big problem for sleep. In terms of the question that came up earlier about a physical book versus a tablet, one of the things that we learn as Reach Out and Read providers is how to use that book to engineer our entire questions around child development. A six-month-old is going to take the book, and when I hand it, I say, watch this. He's going to hit it. He's probably going to put it in his mouth and bite it. He's going to drop it and see if you pick it back up. That's all okay. That's why it's made out of cardboard. And we talk about how this book brings people together. The literature still hasn't been built on the developmental differences between, say, a tablet book and a physical book like the ones that are, you know, mentioned on our tables. But what Dimitri will say is kids need laps, not apps. He made that up. I'm so jealous. Bright guy.
We'll work on it.
Yeah, I'm still working. I'm trying out different, you know. But I think where the electronics bring the kids together, and one of the things in our new guidelines that we recommended, we said, okay, it's not a moratorium on electronics and kids, but ask yourself, are we going to look at this together? Am I going to Skype with grandma out of town? Great. Wonderful. Are we going to sit together and watch this program or use this app? Fantastic. But tapping and swiping at a screen looks like learning. But none of the literature right now suggests that it's applicable to anything outside of the thing on the screen. And most educators would say that if you can't take the thing you learned here and apply it over there, it's not translational learning. And so we still tell parents, you know, get your kid in your lap and pay attention to the same thing together. That's what we're looking for.
Great, fantastic. Dr. Grundle, what about families and trauma? There's a lot of trauma out there, more than we ever realize, kind of in everyday life. And how can we, and especially the question that came up about working with caregivers that are not necessarily the traditional biological parent of everyone's stereotype, how about engaging with them, and how can approaches like Reach Out and Read help engage those families?
So let me begin by asking, how many of you have your phones with you? Right, y'all do. Could you turn them off? Turn them off right now. Okay. So what you're feeling is called stress. I'm asking you to do something that's stressful. And if I really bugged you about it, the cortisol level in your body and your brain would go up like crazy. You know, when we study children, we talk about that as a spit test. So if I wanted to spit test you, I would find that your cortisol levels are high. That's stress. When stress is, and we all have it, right? We all have it. When stress is not reduced or released by a positive buffer, who is usually the parent or the caregiver, it gets to toxic levels and it changes the way, when children are young, their brain is actually structured and it functions. We didn't understand that for a long time. We've understood it for 10 years. We've been a little slow in the uptake about what do we do with that stuff. So toxic stress for families happens to all of us. It happens to all of us. The question is the context in which that occurs and how that gets remediated and how chronic it is. So I'd like to say four things. I'll say them really fast. Okay, in this, five things.
Four and a half.
So you give a developmental psychologist a microphone who works with kids, and guess what? You're in trouble. So four and a half, really quickly. I never think about children independent of a circle of their family and a circle of their community and a circle outside that, which is all that other stuff. So that's basically who I am. I don't think we can do good work any other way, and we've tried for a really long time. So the policy and politics stuff would be on that outer side. So that's the first half of the first one. Okay. There are four key constructs that help us to know why we should support Reach Out and Read, but also would help all of us in how we think about this. The first is that we know there are some structural things that are really bad for all kids. So poverty, scarcity, racism, implicit bias, and today, politics. I didn't have that on my list until recently. I spent a week in Virginia last week, and that was clearly a toxic kind of feeling for people. And it's just like when I ask you to turn off your phone, but bigger, because you can't escape it. So those structural things are there, and they induce stress in families. Then there's all this learning that we know about trauma and ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, which when you get them when you're three, the more you have, the more likelihood of developmental disabilities, and the more challenged your health is going to be when you're 50 or 60, and we're seeing that now. So there are biological consequences of that kind of trauma. So that's the second piece. It took us a long time to get there, and now we're stuck there. So this is where I'd like to go to the other pieces. We know that the first bucket, the poverty and stuff, and the toxic stress and stuff on families and caregivers and children and other people impacts how children's brains grow and fill and what they are filled with. It impacts on the cognitive, social, emotional connection, which go together all the time. We can't separate out those things. And it impacts on our ability to do what's called executive function. How do I plan to get through my day and my week? And self-regulation, how do I control my behavior? Those are really important neuroscience stuff. And if you go to a cocktail party, you should talk about that, because they're gonna think you're really smart and you can talk about neuroscience. Okay. So that's the third bucket. That's just the science. Someone said it. The science is the science. It is. Here's the new piece that I think you went to today, and that is so exciting to me. We're starting to think about if you could replace in your brain, I'm not going to say this as a scientist, just as a parent, if you could replace all that cortisol stuff, which is not that good for us on an ongoing basis, with the stuff that happens when you get a runner's high, or you have other kinds of, I call them happiness hormones, and of course the scientists here will look at me askance, but it's that other thing. When you listen to those stories and you smiled, when you sat around the table and it felt, you felt it here. Well, it's not just your heart, it's the positive side of that biology. So when we look at this arc from poverty and that stuff, through toxic stress, through brain development, where we want to get to is the part that now we're calling mindfulness and empathy. And the Pope said tenderness last week, guys, and we all listened. So there's a positive side of what we're knowing about brain science. We have to go there with families. That's why the strength question was really good. But we have an obligation to not get stuck on toxicity, but we have to fix it, right? And then we have to go to this other space. Listen to kids about mindfulness, and they will tell you where we need to go. Was that like okay?
Thank you. You know, one of the most powerful things that I've started doing at an infant visit at about 4 months of age actually is to just look at families at the end and just tell them that I think they're doing a good job. We forget to do this in healthcare because we're thinking about all the things and, you know, whatever, and checking the boxes in our mind, which is important because there's a lot of things we need to cover. But I always remember that there's two questions being asked in any pediatric encounter. whether it's a well-child visit or a home visit or coming to an agency or whatever, parents are always asking themselves, how's my child doing? And how am I doing as a parent? And if we don't address those things in some way, shape, or form, there's sort of something missing, I think, there.
Could I just say one other thing?
I'll think about it. No.
Okay, this is cheating. But if you think about how you are with a baby, right, what do? You get up close, about this close, because they're wired to be about that far away from you, and you smile and you make these funny sounds. You do the same thing with puppies, by the way. We have a mental schema for baby and puppies, but for people, there's a biology of that, and that's the space we want to be in when you end up with a client or when we talk about reading, because it's close and it's touching and it's breathing together and it makes us feel good too. So that's exactly the space.
I promise not to say that word.
Thank you. That was a wonderful observation. First Lady Cooper, it's a delight to hear about your work, particularly as a guardian ad litem and so on, and working with children and families that are often undergoing a great deal of stress and significant circumstances. What are your main takeaways as to the types of supports that they have needed, both the parents and the children, and how we can play a role in that?
Well, I would say that by the time I enter a child's life, what I'm basically dealing with is already on fire. And we've pretty much exhausted family options by the time a child enters foster care. And not to get political, but part of that has to do with some of the choices that have been made to remove supports that make it possible for families to keep children, like child care tax credits or subsidies, or even the foster care payments that go out to families can be a tenth of what they would pay to a stranger in a foster home. So, we're actually seeing fewer and fewer kids, at least in Wake County, who are with family. Almost, it's been years since I've had a family placement. But what you do see when you talk to the parents, because I get involved with the biological parents at the same time, because we have to work through reunification, and there is a process. And I'm always struck by how multi-generational the problem is. I very frequently find that the parents of the foster children were foster children themselves and don't know the basics. And people are sometimes surprised when I talk to them about children who have been forcibly removed from their homes pursuant to a court order, that really very few of the parents I deal with are bad people. Their main problem is poverty and incompetence. And they really don't understand in many cases because they had no one else to show them their own life. Their own childhoods were often chaotic. And they don't understand about why plugging your kids in front of a television is bad. When I go to visit, I frequently have, not only is the television on, but it's on so loud I can't talk over it. And it's like, no, I know this is your house, but could we just turn the television down because I can't hear over it. But for a lot of people, that may be the only entertainment that they can afford, is that cable bill. So before they don't have the option to take their kids to a concert or Shakespeare in the Park, maybe. So they've got that cable bill. So it does seem very, very intractable sometimes. And it's always amazing to me, we do get a biological parent to go to a parenting class, the revelations they have that would seem commonplace, to people like me. Like, you don't have to hit your kids to get their attention. It's important to talk to your kids, even if a kid can look at a book, even if they're not ready to read it. Oh, my baby doesn't read yet. Well, they don't have to read to enjoy sitting in your lap and looking at a book, and they may flip through the pages, and most of them do. None of those kids in the picture with me were listening to me read the book. There were like six of them, and they were turning the pages, oh, there's a balloon, and then that's something that's totally within the ability of parents to do, and it seems so basic to us, but to hear a parent who's been through a class just talk about, you know, I didn't realize that I could talk to my child. I didn't realize I had alternatives to being to yelling. I didn't understand that. And that just seems like such a basic thing to do. And, you know, one of the things I talked to my husband about was, while we're talking about this is not a good time for government-funded programs right now. So, I mean, it's wonderful to have something that can work, you know, through parents that doesn't, or the children, that's very inexpensive. Most of us donate bags of books just to get them out of the house every time we move. So, you know, it's a wonderful program. It's very accessible, and I'd love to help more.
Thank you very much. I think that, you know, what we're really talking about is this notion, again, of intentional skill building, of helping parents build out those skills to do the job of parenting, the good job of parenting that they want to do. I'll also add that there's a diagram that I came across in my work with Aspen Ascend that gets at the heart of what you were saying about supports as well. This diagram shows as your effective monthly income, as you make more, goes up, how much do you have to run your household with? Well, you'd think that line would go like this, but it doesn't. It goes up, and then there's a cliff when you lose supports at eligibility. And we're actually creating structural disincentives sometimes for families to take better jobs or accept raises or so on, because they'll end up worse off, which is just profoundly bad policy, and no matter how you look at it in different ways. So a question I'd like to throw out for really anyone on the panel, how do we build these skills? How do we work with families? What are the approaches, the kind of prerequisites? How do you frame this to really do things? Because the thing is, particularly families that face these challenges, they have a lot to deal with already, just around housing and food and school and so on. How do you do this in a way that doesn't sound like, oh God, here's something else I'm failing at as a parent? So what sorts of ways can we approach that?
Is this on? Yes. I think starting as early as possible, it was mentioned before, starting prenatally, and I actually see prenatal take care of patients prenatally, and I start that conversation early before the baby's ever there, because we all know when the baby's there, stress levels, cortisol levels are through the roof, and your opportunity isn't less so much, but it's more stressful that they may, if we could start those habits before the baby's ever born, and there's benefit to reading to children before they're ever born. I think one of the videos earlier mentioned that. And so I think starting early is probably the biggest thing that comes to mind for me, to reach out and have those discussions with parents, resources, getting them out into the community resources I mentioned earlier, but I see a lot of teen parents too. And so those parents need even more resources, and we actually have one in our community that helps with parenting classes, and they start before they're ever a parent. And I think that's the key too, is to not wait till we're 5 years behind and the child's already 5 years old, hasn't had a book in their household, already behind in the Head Start program, but they're being held back still. So I think just as early as we can get those things, get the ball rolling for them.
There's a basic positive parenting concept called catch them doing good, right? Rather than telling your kid, put that down, stop that. You're like, I really like how you're sitting there and drawing right now. And, of course, as pediatricians, we kind of do this naturally. But the parents can also get that. And I start, you know, early on at the first infant visits, I'll often walk in and the infant will be gazing at mom or dad, and that's the first thing I'll point out when I walk in the room, if their eyes are open, look how they're looking at your face. And you could speak more on this, but so much of how they learn, how a newborn or a baby learns to emotionally regulate, has to do with what that child is seeing in the parent's face. And so I call that out as soon as I walk in the room. Look, a lot of our parents, especially parents who have a lot of challenges in life, aren't sure their children like them. They think if their kids cry or are unhappy, I'm doing something wrong, this kid doesn't like me. I'm like, look how this child is imprinting on you. And then every time I get a chance to see something else, you know, I love the way you're talking to your child right now. To really sort of reinforce that, we're not asking people to do something that's not fun. this is inherently joyful. Teaching and interacting with a child is what we're wired to do. So it's really easy, I think, to call out those moments that we see it going well and seeing the smile. And I'll say, I love the smile on your face right now. Look how much you're enjoying this. And I just try and really put the spotlight on that.
So to build on what you've said, I think there are some simple things we can do in every exchange, that are the same rules that we talk about on the videos. So naming and showing and coaching and being on the positive side of this is easy for us to do in every single interaction. I mean, that's each one reach one every single time. And we can do that if we can stand outside ourselves and realize we should be doing that, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that and this is a fact, okay, so a scientific evidence fact. In many places, I can only speak about urban settings. I'm not sure about rural settings, but I know I'm going to learn in Connecticut. Somewhere around 50 or 60% of low-income moms are actually clinically depressed. Why? Because they're living in those first two buckets that I talked with you about. And that's incredibly stress-inducing. So we can figure that out. I think Reach Out and Read can play a very important role. And we know how to address that clinically. So there are ways that, in fact, clinical depression, you can help people to grow through and out of that and have different mindsets. So when that's there, we have to actually work on it. That's an intervention. And the last thing for me, having spent a long time in the child welfare side, and also on the correction side, which is about as far back in our system as you can get, we build our systems that put further stress on stressed families, especially low-income families. So we know that depression impacts on families' ability to engage with their children and also on their ability to do all the stuff we tell them they need to do in order to get what little bit of help we give them. So I think if we can look honestly at our systems, and actually here's the best example. I'm your social services person and you have to appear in my office for a variety of reasons, but your kid has to be across town in the same time frame and you have to take 4 buses to get there because you don't have a car, and by the time you get to me, you're late. Well, I did that to you. And actually, that's not evidence of lack of executive function. That's huge planning you had to do in your head to navigate that. So getting into the mindset of our systems, in addition to health, I think, we could change some of our practices in ways that reduce our stressful impact on families that are really stressed. Then they'll be able to read more, right, and engage more.
Well, you know, I love the approach that you're taking where you're communicating orally with parents, because you know what I find is that increasingly at all socioeconomic levels, we're not teaching parenting in the community anymore. That people are not learning from their moms or from their sisters or from their aunts, and that certainly in my group of mothers, it's you buy books. You know, when you find out you're expecting, you go get the books, you go on the internet, you go on the blogs, and increasingly it's literacy based. So if you're dealing with parents quite often who aren't literate and they don't have that resource, and then neither do they have a mother or a grandmother or a sister or really anybody in the community, and you know, quite often the parents that we see are very stressed and very isolated, sometimes in an abusive relationship, and sometimes their families have cut them off and they really don't have a lot of alternatives. So I think that this may be one of the few, you know, positive interactions that they might get that would help them through this.
Thank you. I think the other key word that I hear underlying all this, but I want to call out, is trust. It's really hard to be yet another person coming and saying, "I'm here to help you." I mean, a lot of families have heard that so many times, and it's either these insane situations which are just not feasible for anyone to get through. But if they, over time, and I think we see that in healthcare when we're seeing people over and over, and family physicians, you're seeing them before and in a very different relationship, sometimes caring for the parent as well. So you have more of an opportunity to develop that trust over time. And that trust is really important. And also, sometimes asking them things that they may not get asked. At the 4-month visit, I'm always asking families, tell me what your hopes and dreams are for your child 20 years from now. And then I do something that's very hard for many docs, which is to shut up and listen. And usually doesn't take more than a few sentences, and they're saying about college, and I hope they're educated and happy and secure and all that. I say, great. So now tell me, what are you doing now that you think might get them to that point, that vision you had for them? And they often say things like, I'm talking, I'm reading, I'm singing, I'm playing, and all these things. And great, then I can go and build on that, on these things they're already telling me that they're doing. And strengths-based approaches doesn't mean that you just never can talk about things that aren't a problem. A dad told me proudly in response to that question, oh, I show my six-month-old, we go through ABC videos together on YouTube, and he's holding up his phone. And of course, inside I'm cringing slightly, but I said, that's wonderful that you care so much about your daughter's learning at this young age. You know, let me tell you something. They learn from that, but it's actually because you're there with her. The video isn't doing it, it's actually you. So let me encourage you to put the video down and actually get a great ABC book from the library and do the same thing. And he said, that's great, I'm gonna do exactly that, you know, because it wasn't a big move from what he was already doing, and I told him it was such a good thing. So I think that really, those sorts of little turns, catch them doing good, and then maybe modify just a little bit can be very helpful.